The text that we are looking at today deals with what I think is one of the most significant themes in the Bible that rarely ever gets a great deal of attention. And I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, I heard this idea, the fear of the Lord, but it was always as an adult was approaching me with a switch or something like that. It was the thing that they were about to instill within me with whatever implement of destruction that particular family member, you know, appreciated. My grasp of the fear of God was that it was that you were supposed to be terrified of God. And then when I became a Christian in my 20s in college, and I started reading the Bible, I was shocked that it wasn't that, like, at all. And so it was actually this really rich, and I don't know that I really understood it even nearly as well as it could be understood up until just maybe a couple of years ago. And I'm quite confident it's deeper still than I know, but this is an amazing concept, the fear of God. If I had a theme today, if you're taking notes, this is what it would be. The fear of the Lord is the response to the God of the gospel. Super simple. The fear of the Lord is the response to the God of the gospel. So what does this phrase mean? I always tell this story when I talk about this particular idea. It was probably about 12 years ago now, maybe 12, 15 years ago. My nephew Jackson was probably about 5, and he calls me on the phone. Yeah, he used my brother's number. I answered the phone thing. It was my brother, and it was my 5-year-old nephew. And he goes, "Hey, Uncle Jeff." He goes, "Hey, Dad is going to take me and Jackson on Man Day." And I was like, "Man Day? What's Man Day?" Jackson goes, "I don't know. But Dad said that I could burp and poop and not say excuse me." I said, "That's Man Day." And Jackson, "Yeah, that's Man Day." So I said, "Give me your dad." And he gave me my brother. And I said, "Hey, man, what's going on?" He goes, "My brother's a very successful commercial banker. But, you know, if you're successful in those fields, sometimes you don't get to see your family a lot." So Mark hadn't hung out with his boys for quite a while. And so he was like, "I'm going to take him down this swamp." They lived in Florida, and you know, there's loads of those swamps. You pay about $4 or $5, and you're on the water for about 3 or 4 hours, and you see everything. You see alligators and snakes and everything, you know, and you're just right there with them. Alligators typically will not harm a human. The word typically is why I don't get in the water ever in Florida. That's kind of the mantra. My brother and I have a cousin that would dive into the water and pull them out by the tail. He will never reach my age, I'm confident. That's the kind of thing that you can do with an alligator. And so anyway, they get moving down this swamp, and Jackson is in the middle seat. My brother's in the back seat paddling the canoe. Jackson's in the middle seat, super ecstatic to be with Dad and just chatting at 90 miles an hour. "Dad, have you seen this alligator? Sometimes people eat alligators. I don't know, maybe eat alligators. Alligators are huge, and they're supposed to taste like chicken, but they're bigger than chicken." And I just, you know, on and on and on, just never quit talking. Mark said he just didn't breathe the entire time. Josh, my, at that time, 12-year-old nephew, who was like way too cool for school, is up in the front of the canoe, and he has a brand new iPod. Kids, ask your dad, mom later what that ancient device is, and they'll tell you. But he has his earbuds in, you know, or earplugs in, and he's listening to his tunes. Mark said his paddle never touched the water. He's like in the front, and he's just like listening to his tunes, and so they're just cruising down. And Mark didn't care. There was a little, a current, and so it's no big deal. And so as they go through, and sure enough, there are alligators in there the size of their canoe that, you know, just got to swim past the canoe. And they're, you know, big snakes that they saw, you know, come into the water. And they get to the end, and there's this big tree that had fallen into the stream. And so the people who owned this part of the swamp dug this area around it so that the boats could get to the pier. And there was the pier right there. And so as they went around this little area, they came under a weeping willow tree. You know this tree, right? A weeping willow tree. And as they got under the weeping willow tree, about a 5-foot snake fell into the boat. It hit my brother in his head and went straight down his back into that little triangular spot in the canoe right behind your backside. And Mark instinctively dropped the canoe paddle and launched himself into the water. So Jackson, who has seen all this, but the past 3.5 hours, seen alligators in the water and seen, you know, bigger snakes than he's seen in his yard in the water. And after that, now his dad just went in the water. He just loses it. Dad, dad, dad. Josh is up front of the boat. You know, digging stones. Yeah, so, and so Mark comes up out of the water and he said, everything just became clear at once. I can either stay in the water with reptiles that have mouths that are this big, or I can get back in the boat with a reptile that's got a mouth that's that big. That's easy math. And so he launches himself back in the boat. And as he went back in the boat, he tries to get a hold of the snake. Snake freaks out, shoots between Mark's legs, crawls over Jackson, which sends him into the stratosphere. Dad! Dad! And he's screaming. And so the snake just goes, bolts from the front of the boat, climbs over Josh's right leg and bites him on his left leg. Now Josh is at the party. And so he's up, the iPod goes in the water, he grabs hold of the paddle, he's just slamming it down onto the, you know, this is a canoe. And he's just slamming it down onto the, you know, screaming, die, and trying to kill the snake. My brother crawls over Jackson, finally gets up to the front of the boat, grabs the snake and throws it out. And then he's like, just make sure everybody's okay. You know, Jackson's catatonic at that point, and Josh is freaking out. And then up on the pier, there's this group of people that have gathered together, and they're all watching. And the people in this particular part of Florida would probably satisfy a lot of your assumptions about Southerners. My brother and I are from the South. We grew up in deep in the country in Alabama, and yeah, I mean, stereotypes come from someplace, and they would come from this place that Mark was at. And so they're all standing there, like, looking. And Mark said this big old Bubba kind of guy was, you know, running the pier. And said, get up to the pier, you know. And the guy goes, I couldn't help but notice there's an altercation on the water. And like, okay. Mark says, well, a snake fell in the boat. He goes, ooh. As soon as he said it, he goes, everybody on the pier is like, ooh. And he goes, what kind of snake was it? And Mark said, a live snake. It was a live snake. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, but what did it look like? What did it look like? And so, I don't know. It was brown. It had this yellow stripe. He goes, everybody again was like, ooh. He goes, oh. He goes, I wish you'd have grabbed that and brung him up here. Yeah, that's good eating right there. Mark's like, what? Okay, so at this point in the story, I'm in my floor in the office laughing at Mark, yeah, telling me the story on the phone. And after it's all happened. But what I started thinking of later was what was going on in that moment. In that moment, the same snake generated two radically different responses. My family, well, you know, apparently believed that this was a spawn of Mordor that was going to devour them all on the water. And they were just, you know, they were freaking out about it. Jackson's in fetal position in the boat, snake, you know, kind of thing. And Josh is acting like he's some Vietnam commando that got shot. He's crawling on the pier. Oh, tell mom I love her. Go on without me. Yeah, it's not even a poisonous snake, right? And then the other group is like, it's an entree. It's like, ooh, this is tasty. Oh, them things are so good, you know? And they had no fear of this snake. In fact, the snake probably was trying to get out of the boat because he knew that if he made it to the pier, he was done. And so it's just so incredible. But here's what was happening. There was assessment, what is this? And then there was natural response. Assessment, natural response. That's the fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord is the assessment of something, natural response, the assessment of God. Fear of the Lord shows up all kinds of places in the Bible. Here in Proverbs, the beginning of wisdom and knowledge, as it's a source of life and protections. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, turning a person from the snares of death. Whoever fears the Lord has a secure fortress for their children, it'll be a refuge. It's a characteristic of righteous individuals. Job is a man from Uz that was blameless and upright, one who feared God, shunned evil. It's a command from God. in Deuteronomy. Now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask but to fear the Lord your God? Walk in obedience, love him, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. It's a way to avoid evil. Fearing the Lord is to hate evil. It's a quality that brings blessing. Blessed are those who fear the Lord. Description of God's followers. They're the ones who fear the Lord, his holy people, because those who fear him lack nothing in the Psalms. These ideas are powerful ideas, but even more suggestive of what the fear of the Lord is the fact that oftentimes the fear of the Lord is motivated by God's goodness. It's God's goodness that motivates the fear of God sometimes. For example, in Hosea chapter 3, verse 5, afterward the children of Israel will return. They will come back. They will be restored. They will seek their God and David their king, and they will fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Psalm 86, 11 connects an undivided heart to fearing God. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness. Give me an undivided heart that I might fear your name. Deuteronomy 10, 12 associates fearing God with living in a way that pleases him. Now, Israel, what does the Lord require of you? He requires only that you fear the Lord your God and live in a way that pleases him and love him and serve him with all your heart and soul. Psalm 111, 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. All who follow his precepts have good understanding. Or Deuteronomy 14, the tithe, a great tithing feast, that after a year you gather all of your grain and your wine and your oil and your meat, a tenth of it, and you gather it at a table and you enjoy this meal with the poor, with the Levite, anyone that can come to it. And you know what you do it for? You do all that to fear God, to learn to fear God. Nobody ever told me when I was a kid, now if you really want to learn to fear God, you need yourself a really good meal. Nobody said that. You need to really kind of get in touch with the idea that God is profoundly good. And then that will teach you to fear the Lord. Nobody said that. But that's exactly what the Bible says. The Bible then understands fearing God as this, an unswerving confidence in God. It's an unswerving confidence in God. I think fear of the Lord is the way that the Old Testament talks about what the New Testament calls faith. This is not simply ascending to propositions. In fact, some of these critiques of Israel would have completely said, of course we believe in God. We're the children of Abraham. They wouldn't have even said we believe in God in a little G way. They would have said we believe in the God of Israel. But they didn't. The fear of the Lord is this visceral, obvious response that is connected to unswerving confidence in God's reality, in his goodness. It's what I would call a totalizing worldview. It's not just simply something that corrects your morality. That's just any religion tries to do that. Every religion that I've ever bumped into tries to do that. Oh, this is the moral package you live by? Well, just exchange this, and here, I'll give you this new moral package. This new moral package, by the way, suspiciously looks like me, but I'll give it to you, and now you live by this, and if you live by this really well, then God will appreciate you. He'll like you. That's a horrible way to live. Now, this is a totalizing worldview. This is the expression internally of what you know and see and grasp of who God is. Thus, the source of fear is the God of the gospel. So how do you feel about God? How do you think about God when you think about him? When I was growing up in Alabama, we had all kinds of really interesting concepts about God. That if you ask me, what are God's attributes? What are his characteristics? I think I would have just described probably to you one of the people in my church, right? That I just thought probably was more God-like than the rest of us. And they would have probably, you know, sounded very much like the culture I grew up in. There's a writer, Greg Gilbert, he wrote this little bitty book, super helpful, called What is the Gospel? And he talks about his take on how people view God. So let me read this to you and See if this is something that might sound familiar to you. He's a little bit sarcastic, so sarcasm is the air we breathe in the Mooney home. So if it's not for you, my apologies. But it's a little bit sarcastic, but it's still accurate, I think, in the way that some people think about God. Quote, "Let me introduce you to God." Note the lowercase g. "You might want to lower your voice a little before we go in. He might be sleeping now. He's old, you know, doesn't much understand or like this newfangled world anymore. His golden days, the one he talks about when you really get him going, were a long time ago before most of us were even born. That was back when people cared what he thought about things and considered him really important to their lives. But of course, all that's changed now, though, and God, poor fellow, just never adjusted very well. Life's moved on, passed him by. Now he spends most of his time just hanging in the garden out back, and I go there sometime to see him, and we tarry there walking and talking softly and tenderly among the roses. Anyway, a lot of people still like him, it seems. He manages to keep his poll numbers pretty high. And you'd be surprised at how many people even drop by to visit and ask for things once in a while. But of course, that's all right with him. He's here to help. Thank goodness all the crankiness you read about sometimes in his old books, you know, having the earth swallow people up, raining fire down on cities, that sort of thing. All that seems to have faded in his old age, and now he's just a good-natured, low-maintenance friend who's really easy to talk to, especially since he almost never talks back. And when he does, it's usually to tell me through some slightly weird sign that what I want to do, regardless, is all right by him. And that really is the best kind of friend, isn't it? You know the best thing about him, though? He doesn't judge me, ever, for anything. Oh, sure, I know that deep down he wishes I'd be better, more loving, less selfish, and all that, but he's realistic. He knows I'm human and nobody's perfect. And I'm totally sure he's fine with that. Besides, forgiving people is his job. It's what he does. He's love, right? And I like to think of love as never judging, only forgiving. That's the God I know, and I wouldn't have him any other way. End quote. I meet people all the time at a university who think that. They have this concept of God that is the most Pollyanna, pedestrian sort of God. I was an atheist before I became a Christian. And if that was the God you were trying to sell me, I would have smiled at you and said, I don't know. I'm not sure what the need is for such a being in the universe. He sounds so chestless. I don't know what that is that you're describing. This is the thing that I'm supposed to be grateful for, that loves me? Of course he loves me. He sounds desperately needy. That's a weird idea of God. Christian Smith wrote in his book, Almost Christian, not talking about him, but he's a social theorist from Notre Dame. He said that the current generation, you can check this out with, especially those of you who are involved in public schools and stuff like that, and universities. But he said the current generation perceives God through the lens of moralistic therapeutic deism. The point is God exists, he created and watches over the world, he wants people to be good and fair to one another and to allow each other to be whoever they are. The central goal of life is to be happy and feel good about yourself. God's not really involved until someone asks him to be involved. That's the deism aspect. He stays off to the end and we become the most central element. And God's just like a condiment when necessary to kind of sprinkle on our lives. That's a really interesting thing. I gotta tell you, if in fact that's how people think of God, then it would be no wonder for me why they would feel no appeal to God, no draw to God. If they did find themselves looking in the mirror, which we all do at some point, realizing that we are hopelessly short of our own sense of morality and standards, and what is there out there that might forgive us, they're never going to find it in a God like that. They're never going to hope in a God like that. This God is not going to engender affection. This God is not going to engender a sense of desire and delight. But the God of the Scriptures does. The God of the Scriptures is spoken of as eternal, creator of all things. As a title mentioned, his prayer, immutable. He never changes, which means that everything about him never changes. Get this. His love is eternal, unchanging, undefiled by time, situations. So those things, believer, those things that you sin, that you've fallen short on, God's love is profoundly unchanging. He knew what he was doing. He knew how sinful you are when he died. He's never changed his love for you, regardless of how profoundly you have fallen short of him. That's an amazing way. Nobody loves you like that. Nobody does. And I'm a guy, by God's grace, I'm loved by a lot of people. I have people that my family, my wife still loves me, which is extraordinary. And my kids love me. My grandkids, this ever-growing tribe of grandkids, which I'm super happy about, love me. I've got students who still love me. These people over here love me still. I'm not lacking in love. No, I don't have daddy issues. My dad and mom loved me. So I'm telling you, though, this love is categorically, radically different. No one will ever love you as strong and as long as Jesus. No one will ever be able to do that. The deepest and most profound love I can have as a human being has a shelf life on it. And the older that I get, the shorter that shelf looks. And it's over, but not Jesus. It's extraordinary, eternal, unchangeable, all-knowing, strong, eternally strong, judge of all the earth. And this is a problem, of course, because when you read what the Bible says about human beings, we don't naturally fit. Like, you've probably been around the individual. I'm an introvert, and I love being by myself and things like that. But, you know, when I knew that I was, you know, going in the ministry and things like that, you just can't act like that in the ministry. And so I trained myself by watching people that were really good with people to, you know, be able to stand up and talk and, you know, and interact with people without, you know, coming across as like terribly weird. I still come across as weird probably, but not terribly weird. And so there's a sense of me, you know, wanting to interact. But there's this disconnect between humans is really significant. And this is the way I would talk about it. You are sinful down to your appetites. You're not a sinner because you sin. You sin because you're a sinner. You are naturally wound up like that. And so, for example, if I had two big cages up here on the stage with me, and I had one of those beautiful deer that I saw just traipsing through your town last night over here, and I had a wolf over here, if I was to throw like a big piece of London broil raw meat in with the deer and then a big head of lettuce in with the wolf, my guess is neither one of them would be happy about that. The deer would probably be freaked out by the London broil, and the wolf would just be staring at the deer and the London broil. He doesn't even know what to do with that lettuce. Their appetites do not fit. Our appetites don't fit with God. Growing up, I was given this line of reasoning that because I was human, it was because I was made in the image of God, that I just naturally had this appetite for God, and God naturally had this appetite for me. But that is not true. My appetites betray the fact that my heart is given over to me as God. Image of God's not enough for human beings. We want to be the thing that we can never be. And so we give ourselves over to any number of things, whether it's in good things, family, friends, country, job, and sometimes immoral things. All to try to create this sense of ultimate happiness and find someone to save us from ourselves. But it doesn't work. Our appetites continually betray us. The thing that's ever going to change us has to be this God that is at the core of reality. And he does that with Jesus. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree. We just read that today when we were singing. That is the reality of how we're rescued. Jesus rescues us from ourselves by going to the cross, absorbing the wrath of God against us, absolving the justice of God against us. But it's even better. We're not just forgiven. We're justified. God doesn't say, Jeff, okay, you're forgiven. You're okay now, so go. He says, no. He says, Jeff, you're justified. Come in. See, it's deep and profound love. It's not some arbitrary social construct or decision I'm making. And this kind of love is extraordinary. There's an acclaimed foreign film called Three Seasons. And it's a series of vignettes about life in post-war Vietnam. And back in 2006, a New York Times reporter wrote a review of this movie. This is probably not like a family night movie. In fact, it's definitely not. But it's extraordinary. It was one of the stories is about how a cyclo driver, it's like a bicycle rickshaw driver, and the other person is Lon, and she's a beautiful prostitute. And both having these deep, unfulfilled desires. The driver's in love with Lon, but Lon lives in abject, ruthless poverty and works as a prostitute to try to get out of it, but the more she works in these fancy hotels that are there in Vietnam, the deeper she's in poverty. She can't get out. All she wants to be is normal. She wants to be like all of you. She wants to be a mom, have a kid, have someone care about her. But she's not. She's just treated like a Dixie cup. Done with her, throw her out the back, the service entrance. Till the next night. So, Hi, in the middle of the movie, enters into a rickshaw race. I myself did not know such competitions existed in the world, but they do apparently. And so High enters this rickshaw race and he wins. He wins this massive amount of money. And instead of doing what you would expect him with, maybe investing or something like that, he goes straight to Lon. And he says, I want you in that hotel tonight. He pays for her fee, pays for the hotel room. And it's a Sundance Film Festival. Everybody surely is confident that the next scene is going to be something, kind of seedy. But it's not. High gets up there, and Lon gets up there, rather, and High says, I'm not a normal customer for you. Tonight, he goes, I want you to order room service, everything you want to order. I want you to sleep in this bed. I just want to watch you go to sleep, and then I'll leave. I just want you to enjoy everything you never get to enjoy. The writer of the story was moved by this, and this is not a Christian writer. And he said, Hi, went back to his rickshaw, went back to business. He said, but Lon, he says, something snapped in Lon. And the reason it snapped is because she had never had a man who had all authority over her use that authority to love her. And the writer said, love like that leaves trauma. And he's right. Love like that leaves a mark. Love like that changes an individual. When the writer says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, the beginning of knowledge, this is what he's saying. The way to perceive God rightly, and then this visceral response of unswerving confidence, this is the beginning of you seeing the world as the world is. It's really as the world is. Not in a specific, maybe American way, or not in a country way, or a city way, or a white way, black way, brown way, whatever. It's all too small. You begin to see the world the way the world really is, because now the God of the universe has captured your affections, your appetites, your heart down at the deepest level. I would never be religious if it hadn't been for Christianity. I'm quite confident that I would have, that right now I would be somewhere else, not at your church or anybody else's church. But Jesus wasn't an idea. Jesus is alive. The resurrected Christ is the Christ who called me out of darkness and into his marvelous light. It's the resurrected Christ who called me and beckoned me to see the world through eyes I would have never seen. This is the grammar. This is the basics, the ABCs of wisdom. Wisdom is a way to look and see and act and live in the world. You can't do it without seeing it the way it really is. Because if you do, and this is a good test to see how you fare at fearing the world. Have you abandoned all hope in whatever you had hope in for ultimate happiness and salvation and thrown that hope solely onto Jesus? Have you abandoned all hope in anything you had hope in for ultimate happiness and salvation and thrown that hope onto Jesus? Have you seen the world like Jesus sees the world? Or does the world just look to you like a series of cultural enemies that you make? People you need to labor against and fight against and hammer down? Or do you see them as people who desperately need the gospel? Your king and mine said, go into all the world with the gospel, teaching them everything that I've commanded. I'll be with you always. Do you see the world like that? Do you see your money like that, or do you cling to it? Do you have the ambitions that naturally pour from knowing the Christ of the universe, the resurrected Jesus? Do you fear death as if there is no life afterwards? Or like Reaper Cheap in C.S. Lewis's books, you draw the sword and say, death will be a great adventure. Do you understand the world around you because you've been captured, arrested by this death-shattering, sin-destroying gospel? See, this is not just simply religion. This is you and I being commandeered by the grace of God, arrested in our minds and hearts, our affections being created for the first time in ways that we never had them. And now we feel deeply. We love our enemies. Nobody does that. Well, Jesus does. And so Jesus' people do. Not because they've got to, or he'll spank them kind of thing, but because Jesus' heart now is theirs. His eyes are now fixed on theirs. This is difficult stuff. That's why we come to church. We come to church every week, not because it's just a routine. We come to church every week because we need to hear the gospel of God revisited over and over and over. I don't know about you, but the most true thing I've ever sung in my life, we sang today. Prone to wonder, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Take my life, Lord. Take it. Seal it. I will grab hold of it and I'll run away if you don't. Your sovereignty and goodness that saved me has to be your sovereignty and goodness that keeps me. This is what you come here for. You come here because you need the people around you to sing to you and to speak to you and to play with your kids, and to drink coffee with you, to talk about the weather with you, all knowing that you're bound together by the Spirit of God, reminding you that the narrative that you get out there No matter where it's coming from, no matter what television channel it's coming from, the narrative you're getting out there is not the narrative that you're getting in here. This is the true narrative. This is the way to see the world. And by God's grace, you'll engage the world for his glory, for your joy, and for the peace of all of those who will sing to the glory of the Lamb because you reached them with the gospel. I pray that you would be edified and encouraged by the Spirit of God, that the grace of God would bless you and keep you and cause his face to shine on you for his great glory. Father, in the name of Christ, thank you so much for these brothers and sisters. And I pray that they and I would learn to fear you, learn to feel this unswerving confidence for you. And that, Father, that you would draw us into your presence by your Spirit and give us pictures of who you are. We would see them in the scriptures. We would hear them and see them in the songs that we sing. We would listen to the encouragement of brothers and sisters around us and build one another up so that we might see you more clearly, we might feel your presence and fear you and know that you have loved us and provided for us in the deepest of ways. I pray, Father, that we would be known by this and that you'd be glorified by it. In the name of Christ, amen.